we're so used to seeing things that, in my opinion, aren't quite right in our treatment of animals.
The less we eat, the less violence is being done, and the less destruction to the environment.
Everyone eats, and everyone has to make a moral decision every time that we sit down to the table.
Welcome to Animal Voices, Western Canada's only radio program dedicated to animal advocacy and compassionate living. This is 100.5 FM, Vancouver Co-op Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, unceded Coast Salish territories. Today is Friday, September 14th, 2018. I'm your host, Elise Jacobson, and I'm joined here in the studio today by my guest co-host, Sinead Sanders.
Hello.
And our control room operator, Allison Cole.
Hi there.
Today's episode of Animal Voices is brought to you by Edible Planet, a Vancouver-based education campaign and TV series designed to teach people about the world's most powerful edible plants and the fascinating people who bring them to market. Food is the world's most powerful tool to share the wealth, help chronic illness, regreen the planet, and create lasting world peace today. Now is the time for a plant-based economy because on this big, beautiful, edible planet, the food we eat can change the world. Tomorrow, September 15th, is both Greenpeace Day and Coastal Cleanup Day, so we have a segment coming up in a few minutes that will look at how animal agriculture affects our oceans. And our feature interview today is with Vancouver-based vegan activist and entrepreneur Joanne Chang. Joanne is co-founder and co-owner of our local vegan shoe store, Nice Shoes, and has been a vegan and animal rights activist for many years. She'll be speaking with us about her experiences running a vegan business. That interview is coming up in just over half an hour, so stay tuned. But first, Sinead, you had some thoughts for us on a recent trip.
Yes, indeed. I was in Nelson, BC, during the last week of August, and just visiting some family and doing some work stuff. And I used to live in Nelson about 15 years ago, and I hadn't been back in over a decade. So I was interested. I was curious to see how how much it had changed. And when I lived there, I was basically vegetarian. And so going back 15 years later as a vegan, I thought, oh, okay, well, my first thought was actually, I won't have any problems finding food there. You know, they got this reputation as, you know, the tree hugger town and everything. And surely they'd have gotten on board with this vegan thing. They weren't quite as gung-ho on it as I expected them to be after all these years.
Wow.
There were some places that I was very happy to find. I didn't have time to do any extensive exploring, so this is not an extensive list of the vegan experiences you may have in Nelson, but yes, definitely goes... number one place that comes to mind would be the Enlightened Coconut, which is a plant-based ice cream parlor, which I was thrilled to just happen across one day.
That's cool.
I had a sundae for the first time in years. I can't remember the last place I was able to just go and get a sundae.
Pizza Pie in Seattle.
Oh,
yeah. You can get a sundae from there.
Actually, even Rain or Shine ice cream in Vancouver,
yes,
you can get
vegan sundae.
Yeah. Okay, well, I got places to go.
Yeah.
So the ice cream that they use is made by the same people who run the shop. So the ice cream company is called Celestial Scoop, and then the shop is called The Enlightened Coconut, and you can buy their pints of ice cream around town. And my dairy slurping... My sister and father both loved the ice cream.
Oh, cool.
So it comes highly recommended. And right next door to the Enlightened Coconut, there's a place called Sprout, and they're all vegan, and they have good like bowls and things with all sorts of tasty, healthy stuff. There's lots of stuff around town. Some of the bakeries, they'll have, you know, just one or two really good vegan things. But I was honestly surprised at how I went, and there were, they made a point of having gluten-free versions of just about everything in so many of these places, but then only one or two vegan options.
Well, sometimes I find that there's the gluten-free, but there's clearly nothing marked as vegan. So this is part of my activism, what I always do. I just did this the other day at work. I go in and I go, do you have any vegan items or any vegan baked goods? I did this like two nights ago at this little coffee shop by my work, and I've been going there for years. I'm like, well, haven't been there for a long time. And I thought, well, maybe they've gotten on the vegan bandwagon by now because there's a lot of students around here, and all these things could be made vegan. They're so, they look so good.
Right.
And I went in and I said, do you, like, there's nothing there. I'm like, do you, and he's like, can I help you? Do you have any vegan baked goods? He said, he pointed to the lasagna and the veggie samosa, and my eyes are really bad, so I thought it said vegan lasagna, and then I peered closer, and it's veggie lasagna. I said, does that have dairy?
Uh-huh.
And he said, yes. So some people are still clueless.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it takes a while for some of these things.
We actually, we wound up driving out to... through the Slocan Valley on one particular day, and there's a cafe there called Mamacita's Cafe, and I asked the woman at the counter there, I said, are any of these baked goods vegan? And she goes, we have a vegan cupcake here, but they always sell out so fast. And so we
then why don't you make more?
We had a bit of a conversation. She said, you know, I don't get it with the gluten-free thing. That's been scientifically refuted, and there are all these reasons to not eat animal products that are scientifically backed, and we're actually being urged by scientists to consume less animal products, and yet everybody still locks onto this gluten-free thing.
That's true.
But, but anyway, so, I mean, there have been, I can't say there have been no changes over the past decade since I'd been, but I mean, it is still a small town. It's sort of just, it made me think of how in Vancouver here we have Commercial Drive and Kitsilano, these areas that are sort of seen as have historically been seen as sort of hippie neighborhoods or sort of progressive or this or that, and they have this reputation for that. But in reality here, while there might be more of a concentration in those areas of some vegan options, there is still a lot of misunderstanding as far as the impact of animal agriculture on these things we're claiming to want to protect, like the environment, right?
You know? Well, and going back to the gluten-free thing too, I can't tell you how many times I've asked, you know, in cafes or whatever, do you have any vegan options? And they're like, oh, well, no, but we have gluten-free, as if it's interchangeable, you know? And it's like, well, I don't really care about hurting wheat. I care about hurting animals.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but, you know, it really, it had me wondering about other small towns. It didn't seem like there was a very strong animal rights presence in Nelson, but I wondered, Elise and Allison, if you had any particular experiences in other small towns around BC.
Yeah, I mean, I travel a lot, you know, just being a professional musician, I end up, you know, going all over the place kind of to perform. And I guess I'm in Kamloops pretty frequently, and there's, I don't know, I guess being there so often, I feel like it's a little bit limited. I've sort of exhausted all the vegan options there, but it's pretty decent, you know, especially if you're just passing through. There's some pretty good options. There's a cafe that I love called The Art We Are. They have a bunch of options in Kamloops, and they even have a Walkbox location there, and Walkbox has started to use Yam Chops vegan chicken, I think, at all their locations, so that's nice. And yeah, what else? I find Happy Cow really useful when I travel. I'm surprised sometimes by a lot of... I feel like most vegans know about Happy Cow, but I feel like I still meet a lot of vegans who don't know about it. Happy Cow, the app, or the website happycow.net, it's super helpful when you're traveling around, even to small kind of remote towns. It has all the... typically has all or most of the vegan friendly places listed, and tells you exactly where they are, and it's just super handy, exactly how far away they are from you.
Mm-hmm. Well, that for me was over 50 kilometers, as I was mentioning before, on a drive back from the interior of BC. So, we weren't in the Kamloops area, but there were a couple places in Kelowna, and we were driving back home, and everyone was going to stop where I wanted to stop because I was the only vegan in the vehicle.
Yeah.
And I'm desperately, like, I had the Happy Cow on. I'm like, what's within 50 kilometers that we're going to run into? And there was nothing. The closest thing was in Hope, I think. So
Hope has some spots. Kelowna actually has. I've had amazing vegan
but I recommend going to a chain, like a big chain place. We went to the White Spot on the way there and Boston Pizza on the way back, and my $29 pizza wasn't really affordable. I wasn't paying for it, my work was, but I put everything I wanted on it, but and I made it extra large so I could share it with my colleagues, because I'm always thinking of vegan outreach with food.
Yeah,
and they liked it, and but it was $29.
Yeah, wow.
So, but it's not to say you can't be vegan and travel.
Yeah,
and,
of course,
and always pack food as well.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. 2018 Accordion Noir Festival, Friday to Sunday, September 14th through 16th at the Wise Hall. Friday night opens with Vancouver's klezmer troublemaker Jeff Berner facing off with accordion hero Jason Webley at his first local appearance in almost 10 years. Saturday squeezes on with the roof-shaking Dreadnought side project, the bellowing frenzy known as Polka Time. Sunday, consummate the festival with the hauntingly romantic squeezings of Wendy McNeil and a menage of special guests. The 11th Annual Accordion Noir Festival, Thursday to Sunday, September 14th through 16th. All events at the Wise Hall, 1882 Abenaki in Victoria. Full details and schedule, accordionnoirfest.wordpress.com.
You haven't had too much accordion already, have you? Yeah! You haven't overdosed on accordions, have you? Yeah! I want to encourage responsible accordion listening.
And now for some events. This Sunday, September the 16th at Jericho Beach is Vancouver Orphan Kitten Rescue Association's annual Walk for Kitties. That's Vokera's largest fundraising event of the year. This fun 5-kilometer walk takes place at Jericho Beach, and all funds raised go directly towards supporting the rescue of cats in Vancouver. As a volunteer-driven nonprofit, Vokera relies on the Walk for Kitties to raise much-needed funds to help rescue more than 1,400 cats and kittens each year. Each walk participant pledges to raise funds for Vokera to help them in their mission to end cat overpopulation and homelessness. Tickets are $25, and the walk takes place from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. this Sunday, September 16th at Jericho Beach. You can find more info on their websites, orphankittenrescue.com. And then on Wednesday, September the 26th, it is the premiere of the documentary Dominion here in Vancouver. This is at UBC Robson Square. Dominion is a groundbreaking Australian documentary which exposes the dark underbelly of modern agriculture through drones, hidden and handheld cameras. The feature-length film explores the morality and validity of human dominion over the animal kingdom. It's being presented by Liberation BC in partnership with our friends at Surrey Chicken Save and the Vegan Project. A panel discussion will follow the screening, and again, that's 7 to 10 p.m. on Wednesday, September the 26th at UBC Robson Square. Are either of you two going to that one?
Let's see, 26th. I might be in town. I might go. Mm-hmm. That's been highly anticipated. People have been asking about that for months.
I missed the premiere in LA this year when I was there because I was sick, and now I have to work on this night. But, however, I am going to watch it tonight and prepare interview questions because I'm hoping to interview the filmmaker next week on next week's Animal Voices show. So I will know all about it by tomorrow, actually.
Awesome.
Yeah, I'm watching it tonight.
Yeah. Excellent. Yeah. Another film screening coming up Thursday, October 4th, An Evening with Jane. So this is actually much more than a film screening. This is a screening of a new documentary called Jane, which is about primatologist Jane Goodall. It was directed by Oscar-nominated director Brett Morgan. And Jane Goodall will be there. There will be a screening of the film, and then Jane Goodall will be there for a 45-minute Q&A after the show, which sounds like a great night.
Yeah, I really want to check that out. I love Jane Goodall. She's mm-hmm. amazing.
Yeah, so An Evening with Jane takes place Thursday, October 4th at the Center for Performing Arts downtown. This is a special charity event to raise funds for the Jane Goodall Institute of Canada, which promotes the understanding and protection of chimpanzees and other great apes along with their habitats. Tickets are $45 and they're going fast, So you can get yours through the VIFF website, VIFF.org. And that's 6:30 p.m. Thursday, October 4th at the Center for Performing Arts.
Awesome.
If you have any animal-friendly or vegan-related events that you'd like to have us announce on the show, you can send us an email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com.
Awesome. Thank you, Sinead. So next up, we'll be playing for you a short panel discussion featuring authors Hope Bohanic, David Robinson-Simon, and Dr. Will Tuttle, talking about how consumer demand for animal products affects ocean acidification and ocean dead zones.
I have no science background whatsoever, but I did read, and someone said that a very large source of oxygen on the planet is our ocean. And I've also been reading that we're having an issue with ocean acidification and ocean dead zones and coral reef bleaching. Does the animal agriculture have anything to do with ocean acidification, ocean dead zones, and coral reef bleaching?
Well, yeah, I mean,
it's clearly connected in a whole lot of ways. Most of the runoff from the land, I mean, everything that we do on the land ends up in the water. And the huge amounts of pesticides, herbicides, fungicides, all these toxic wastes, plus all the nitrogen that we're pouring on the fields in the Midwest and everywhere in this country. It's called nutrient-rich runoff, which sounds good, but it's really terrible because it goes in and it kills off. It causes algae blooms, which suck the oxygen out of the water, so fish cannot live. They just die off. And we have these huge dead zones now because of animal agriculture, because of the use of so much fertilizer. Back in the 1910s, two scientists in Germany discovered how to create nitrogen out of natural gas, and so that started the big boom where we started eating a lot. The population explosion and animal agriculture took off. Without that, we couldn't have this whole thing. It's the ability to create nitrogen from natural gas, to create, to just keep, you know, using the same piece of land over and over again every year to grow corn and soy to feed to animals, that could never happen. In the past, we had to let the land lie fallow, let the nitrogen come back. You had to plow under leguminous plants to recharge the nitrogen. You don't have to do that anymore. And so this is destroying the oceans. Plus the fact we are overfishing the oceans, not just from fish, but we're fishing for plankton. Plankton create oxygen. The plankton are being strip mined. The fish are being strip mined, and so the oxygen, the power of the oceans to produce oxygen, is being reduced by animal agriculture. Also, so the acidification also is connected to animal agriculture, and I think we see essentially. Animal agriculture, these animals create so much manure, we don't know what to do with it, right? It ends up in the oceans, it ends up eventually in the water tables and other places. And so underlying all of this, I think it would be so great if we could have specials on TV that would kind of educate people about these things. But my father, I was raised in a family of he owned a chain of newspapers, and I learned early on, actually, just sitting around the dinner table, I learned the rule, which is when you own media, you do not run any news that your advertisers are not going to like to see, because they're going to bug you. They're going to say, I'm not going to advertise with you anymore if you run news items that tell me about this, you know. And this is the essential thing, you know, that the media is in many ways at this point completely controlled by these large corporations that don't want people to understand these basic connections that are pretty obvious, really, when you just look at this for a little while and see the connections. It doesn't take great scientists to understand this. It's pretty obvious, but no one talks about it because we're not supposed to solve these problems, because that would perhaps cause financial problems to certain individuals and corporations.
I would add to that also that it's not only land-based animal agriculture that is damaging oceans and coral reefs, but fish farming as well. when fish are wild and their waste is dispersed, the waste has various benefits, like as Hope mentioned, carbon sequestration. But when fish are hyper-confined, their waste is also confined, and it leads to the same problems with nitrogen and phosphorus as land-based agriculture. So that, for example, in Israel a couple of years ago, the government shut down two fish farms in the Red Sea because it found that the waste from those farms had damaged coral reefs, and they thought that the tourist industry was more important than the aquaculture industry. So fish farming is often touted as a silver bullet to solve some of these problems, but I think, as we'll discuss probably in some other examples during this panel, fish farming does not solve the problems either.
Yeah, I could tack on to the fish farming. It's absolutely true. It's basically just industrial confinement, like we do to land animals, to sea animals. I don't know if anyone's ever seen a fish farm, but I have been to a fish farm, and it's interesting because they often are very near, right by a water source. And you'll look at the water source, you know, the river or the area that they're on, the lake or the ocean, and you can see right into it. I mean, it's clear, like water should be to an extent. And then you look into where the fish farm is, and it's just muck. You can barely see in it. It's like deep and dark and disgusting. And it's because the fish are so crammed into these, you know, small pools, they're just living in their waste. The waste is so thick, they're just swimming in their own waste. And these places are just notorious for dumping an arsenal of antibiotics and other chemicals to try to keep the fish healthy enough in this muck to be able to slaughter them for food. So, you know, so yeah, fish farming is absolutely just environmentally horrible. And I did want to mention too, going back to just water pollution, and we talked a little about dead zones, and I wanted to expand on that a little bit. So what happens is that we've concentrated all this waste from these millions of animals that we're keeping. And, you know, I see it in my area. I live in Sonoma County, which is about an hour north of San Francisco, and we have a lot of farming out there, dairy farming mostly, and other farming. And you can see these mountains of waste, and they'll put tarps and tires to hold down the tarps over it. And, you know, so it's just these mountains and mountains of waste. Sometimes there's waste lagoons. I know that pig farms and dairy farms will use waste lagoons where they have dredged an area and lined that area and put the wet manure, made the manure liquid, and it's just this lagoon of waste that is supposedly contained, but of course there's lots of leaching that happens, leaching through the plastic when there's a heavy rain, there's overflow, so it's not really containing the waste. So all of this waste goes down into our groundwater, is going through the water systems and heading out the mouths of rivers. And like Will was explaining, it's high in nutrients, which sounds good, but not in those kinds of high concentrations. What happens is algae feeds on it. There's these algae blooms. It reduces the oxygen in the water and causes what's called eutrophication, which makes basically the water a dead area. There's no oxygen there, and aquatic life can't live. And these dead zones are getting huge. In North America, 48% of lakes are considered eutrophic, containing these excess nutrients. The second largest zone of coastal hypoxia, which is oxygen-depleted water, is found in the northern Gulf of Mexico, out with the outflow of the Mississippi River. So we have so much agriculture in the Midwest coming down the Mississippi. Pesticides contribute to this as well. And there's a huge area, tens of thousands of acres, that's just considered a dead zone. And we're seeing these at the mouths of rivers all over the world. And they're growing, and it's very dangerous. So just wanted to contribute to that.
So
So once again, that was authors Hope Bohanic, David Robinson Simon, and Dr. Will Tuttle. All three of those people have written important books on the animal agriculture industry and the environment. I just wanted to digest that a little bit, talk a little bit about that, because that was some pretty compelling information about how, both fish farms and animal agriculture in general affect our oceans and our environment. Again, tomorrow is both Greenpeace Day and Coastal Cleanup Day, so it's a good time to be thinking about that, about how our choices can affect our coastlines and our oceans and our environment in general. We've talked a lot on this show about these types of issues, about the various impacts that the meat and dairy and egg industries have on the environment and on the ocean specifically. I wanted to ask a little bit, Sinead, too, about like alternatives. Like, do you ever come across, or do you eat a lot of seafood alternatives and that kind of thing?
No, and excuse me. Yeah, I don't eat a lot of the seafood alternatives. Fish flesh was actually the only flesh that I ever ate in my life. I was raised sort of pescatarian, and then I quit when I was a teenager, et cetera. But there are just so many other, there's so many just plant foods, beans and chickpeas, nuts, all these things to eat. I've never particularly reached for the faux seafood products myself.
Yeah.
But
there are a lot nowadays. Yeah. There's like,
What's the best one? The one that I did try was the fishless, the Gardein fishless fillets.
Yeah, those are so good.
Those are really
good. I love
good.
Those with a little follow your heart vegan tartar sauce. Yeah,
yes.
So good.
Yeah, it definitely takes you back.
There's even there's one thing that I really want to try that is available in Vancouver now, I think at a restaurant called West Coast Poke. They have this ahimi. It's this vegan raw tuna. I believe it's made from tomatoes, like marinated tomatoes, if I'm not mistaken. But I've heard it's amazing. I've heard it tastes just like tuna sashimi, and you can get it at least the one place in Vancouver. Other places might have it too. Mm-hmm. And I think, around the country, around other places, you can get it as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's even like, I don't know, I've had vegan smoked salmon that you can buy frozen. I've had vegan shrimp. You can make vegan scallops out of king oyster mushrooms and that kind of thing. And it's uncannily similar.
Yeah.
And it's like,
how's the vegan shrimp? Because it looks very real.
And I know. Yeah. It looks like actual shrimp. It's pretty good. It's like
I don't think I like actual shrimp. So I'm same with seafood in general. Like I was never a fan, and so I've never really had any of the alternatives.
No, miss it.
Other than just to try a couple. Oh, the Gardein has the what's it called? The fishless or crabless?
Yeah,
crab
we were
cakes?
Just. Oh, the crab cakes. Cakes. Yeah,
I've
yeah,
never. Right. I haven't had those.
Those are pretty good,
yeah.
actually.
But yeah, a friend of mine asked me last week what's wrong with shrimp. And then a picture came up on my Facebook today that I wanted to send to him, and it was an illustration of a piece of shrimp, and then for that one little piece of shrimp, all these fishes that are tied up in nets as the bycatch.
Yeah.
Because when you're going trawling for shrimp, you're not just getting shrimp, you're getting everything else in the sea that comes with
right.
it. It's very destructive.
There are a ton of environmental issues with shrimp farming, actually. They're farmed in places where there's those mangrove swamps and that kind of thing, and those are being decimated, and that's having a huge impact on the environment. And shrimp even are, like, there's been studies in recent years that showed that shrimp feel pain, and they can feel anxiety and stuff like that, so they're not just, little inanimate objects. They have feelings. So.
Yeah, actually, they mentioned prawn fishing in an opinion piece in The Guardian this week, which was called "We Won't Save the Earth with a Better Kind of Disposable Coffee Cup."
Mm-hmm.
And it was written by George Monbiot, yes.
And
so in this article, he actually talks about some of the stuff with the oceans and how on BBC program's Blue Planet, how they describe all this beautiful ocean stuff, stuff that we want to save, and then as solutions, they're really just looking at these minuscule little businesses that are maybe trying to hurt less marine life, and right. showing people at the supermarket going, here's my eco-safely harvested prawn, when really it's not, yeah, compared to all the things you could eat instead, you know, it's not ecologically friendly.
Yes.
It's, you know.
Well, and there's been so much talk about plastic straws and stuff lately, but plastic straws, I think, make up 0.03% of the Pacific mm-hmm. garbage patch, and fishing nets and fishing gear make up almost half of the Great Pacific garbage patch.
Yeah.
So it's just sort of a no-brainer, mm-hmm. you know, like just.
Yeah. Oh, One thing that I remember, when I was a kid, we had tuna salad a lot. I've been having right. chickpea salad a lot, just to
yeah.
throw that in there. Recommendation
yeah.
for people. Just
I
mash
love
up
that.
Chickpeas with whatever stuff. So many recipes online, and it's really handy.
Yeah, so good.
All right. You are listening to Animal Voices here on 100.5 FM, CFRO, Vancouver Co-op Radio in Vancouver, BC, Canada, unceded Coast Salish territories. And now for some news, some really, really related news. So speaking of manure lagoons, Hurricane Florence made landfall in North Carolina today and is already said to be the strongest hurricane in almost 30 years to hit the Carolinas, leading more than 1 million people to flee the U.S. coastline. So in addition to the usual destruction associated with hurricanes, North Carolina is one of the biggest hog farming states in the U.S., with about 9 million pigs being raised for slaughter in some 2,300 farms. So that means a lot of manure. In the clip that we just heard describing these manure lagoons, it's pretty scary. So about 10 billion pounds of wet animal waste are produced in North Carolina per year.
Wow.
And yeah, the farms store the pig's feces in these uncovered earthen lagoons the size of football fields. And these lagoons are right in the path of Hurricane Florence. So this is an even bigger public health hazard than usual for a hurricane or for these lagoons, because as we've heard, floodwater or like these... The waste from these lagoons already affects our environment without hurricanes, but with the flooding that's coming, floodwaters that come in contact with pig feces make for a toxic soup that has already been responsible for mass fish kills, algae blooms, dead zones, all sorts of things. So it's pretty scary, and not to mention the fact that the pigs themselves, farmed animals, are not protected. And like legally, hurricanes and stuff, nobody's protecting them. Those mm-hmm. animals are going to drown, and it's going to be awful.
Yeah.
Companion animals get rescued. That's they're legally required to include companion animals in rescue efforts, but farmed animals are just left to die in the horrible conditions they were already in. So that's pretty awful. And these lagoons also affect residents in surrounding neighborhoods who are mostly marginalized groups, lots of Black and Hispanic families who don't have the money to fight these big meat corporations in court to protect their own environment and their own health. So mm-hmm. it's a pretty nasty scene. Basically, animal agriculture is scary, and the meat and dairy industries are now said to be causing more pollution than the fossil fuel industry,
wow.
which is why we're seeing more government efforts to cut back on animal products. Not nearly enough, but one little piece of news that we did hear this week. The Finnish army is fighting climate change by serving vegetarian meals to their soldiers.
Hmm.
In an effort to fight the devastating effects of climate change, they'll be serving fully vegetarian meals on a weekly basis with vegan options available. These meals are going to center on potatoes and pasta with plant proteins and meat alternatives, and they're also making this change in an effort to improve soldier health. So that's also a cool thing to recognize.
Interesting.
And I hope Canada follows suit, because when I saw that, that news story really struck me when I saw it this week, because for an army to be so progressive, with mm-hmm. my experience in the army, it's just mind-blowing that they actually are accepting that idea that it might be healthier to eat more plants, mm-hmm. because typically military food is not very healthy at all.
Yeah.
Kind of going against what you want the soldiers to be. You want them to be strong and fit.
Right. Exactly.
So people are learning.
Yeah. They said that that the Finnish Army will continue to shift toward plant-based meals by providing more vegetables going forward, even if it means increasing expenses for the Army, which is also cool to hear, you know?
That's interesting.
But they're not the first Army to serve meatless dishes. Citing the effects of climate change, in 2013, Norwegian Defense Forces began serving weekly vegetarian meals, and governments around the world are pushing veganism as a way to combat climate change. In 2017, the Scottish Green Party pushed for measures to tackle emissions from animal agriculture, urging the public toward healthier foods that have lower impact on the planet. And the Dutch Council for the Environment has also urged citizens to eat more vegan food. And Germany's Federal Minister for the Environment even banned meat from official government functions, citing climate change. So there is a shift happening.
Yeah, cool. Thank you, Sinead. So moving on, our featured guest today is local vegan activist Joanne Chang. Joanne, I just learned earlier today, was one of the original producers and hosts on this very show, Animal Voices. She's also the co-founder and co-owner of our local vegan shoe store here in Vancouver, Nice Shoes. Hello, Joanne, and welcome to Animal Voices.
Hi, Elise. Nice to be on the show again.
Yeah,
welcome,
yeah, for
Joanne.
Sure. Welcome
nice,
back.
Nice to have you on the show again. I miss you. Can you please come back?
Oh, Allison. That was so much fun when we were doing the show, just the two of us, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. Nice. So, first of all, I'd love to hear about your vegan journey. When did you go vegan, and what motivated you to take that step?
So, I went vegan in 1994. It was a slow, gradual process from becoming a vegetarian 5 years prior to that, and then working my way to becoming vegan. I wish I had a good story to tell, like I ran into some amazing activists that transformed me, but actually the two people that turned me vegetarian and vegan were both meat eaters.
Wow.
Yeah.
How did that
well,
work?
Back then, nobody was talking about veganism, right? So I guess around 1988, 89, a family friend was just, like, telling a story about how he witnessed a sheep being slaughtered. And he said he'll never forget that this sheep, just, like, when he was being slaughtered, just, like, dropped down to his knees and start crying real tears. And he interpreted that as the sheep asking, begging for mercy. And when I heard that, I was like, wait a minute, because at that point in my life, I thought farm animals were destined to be meat, mm-hmm. and that they're somehow willing participants. So when I heard that, I was like, wait, like, so all the meat on my plate, when they were killed, they didn't want to be killed? So that turned me vegetarian right away. So the next day, I was vegetarian.
Wow.
Yeah, and then after that, after I became a vegetarian, my brother, who was a meat eater, still is a meat eater, he was like, oh, so there's a group I think you'll really like. They're called PETA. And so, like, he signed me up for a membership, and then I start getting, like, newsletters from them. And to PETA's credit, even back in the 80s, they were every single newsletter, they were like, go vegan for the animals, go vegan.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's crazy. And then thinking about it now, it's crazy that they were doing that message back then. But then it took me like another 5 years to finally transition in 1994.
Wow. Yeah, that's super cool. So what inspired you and your husband, Glenn, to open a vegan shoe store?
Let's see. We thought about opening a vegan shoe store a long time ago when we heard about Moose Shoes in New York, because that was just such a weird thing back then. It just seemed so exciting to have a shoe store for vegans, but we never seriously considered it. And then until, like, just years before we opened the store, we were doing a lot of street activism. And so we were talking to people on the street, and people were saying that it was too difficult to become vegan because, you know, things are not accessible. And the weird thing that keeps coming up was that people aren't able to find vegan footwear.
Hmm.
So, yeah, and so we like back then, Allison will remember this, like people still called us vegans.
Right. Are you alluding to my age, Joanne?
No, just everybody. Oh. And like we were just weird, and people just thought we were like outsiders. So the idea came that, you know, it was really important to normalize veganism, and so we needed to bring vegans inside. And what that looked like for us was, you know, having more infrastructure locally, like vegan stores, grocery stores, shoe stores, whatever. So just so that vegans can just go in and shop like a normal person without having to feel judged or having to ask a million questions, just to buy like a simple product, like a pair of shoes. Mm-hmm. So from that, the idea of Nice Shoes was born. Yeah.
Cool. So can you elaborate on, just for our listeners, on why vegans choose leather-free footwear? Like, what are some of the main ethical issues with the leather industry?
Well, a lot of people think that leather is just a byproduct of the meat industry, but really, leather is in such high demand, the industry fetches like billions, if not trillions of dollars a year. So it can't be considered a byproduct, it's more like a subsidy of the meat industry. So, because like when a cow is sold, the leather accounts for a sizable percentage of its value, so it's not a byproduct. And like when you get to exotic leathers, the leather is actually more valuable than the meat. So for vegans, if you don't want to fund the meat industry, you should really get leather out of your wardrobe.
Yeah, absolutely. So how have you found operating a vegan business in Vancouver? Are there any unique challenges or benefits?
Well, I think it's really hard running a small business no matter where you are. So I don't think Vancouver presents a specific challenge more than anywhere else. If anything, I mean, we're in a very vegan-friendly city, so we actually have an advantage more than anywhere else.
Yeah. Have you found that it's changed over time?
There are new vegans all the time. Like, I always ask our customers, are you vegan, vegetarian, how long have you been vegan? And the answer is always like, oh, I've been vegan 6 months, 1 year, 2 years. And like, if you've been vegan like 5 years, you're like a veteran vegan.
Yeah.
So awesome. There's like new vegans all the time, but we're just like a growing population, so that's really good. But there's also like perception changes from people who are not vegans. Like when we first opened, I would say like over 90% of our customers are vegans and vegetarians. But now I would say like maybe 30 to 40% are non-vegans. And we get lots of non-vegan repeat customers who have bought something from us that they loved. And then now we become the first store they come to when they're looking for shoes, because now their perception about non-leather shoes have changed.
That's fantastic. Yeah, I guess it seems to me that the shoes themselves have gotten better over the years. It seems like there's just higher quality, better made leather alternatives now. Would you agree?
Yeah, oh, definitely. And there's like all these different, like it used to be that, you know, when you get vegan shoes from a mainstream brand, it's just cheap stuff that makes you sweat and they crack and peel. Or you have to get good vegan shoes. You have to go to England and mail order online and things like that. But like now, even the big brands are doing vegan lines with really good qualities, and the price has gone down too. And such, you don't have sweaty feet.
Such as Doc Martens, because back in the day when I bought mine when I was in high school, their leather, that's all there was. And now, how do they have this whole line of vegan boots and shoes now, right? Like, how do they compare to their counterparts, the leather? And I'm wondering if they're actually, is Doc Martin actually going more vegan now? It might be cheaper, I don't know.
They have a small line of vegan shoes that they make every year, and they actually employ vegans that like give them like ideas of you know what to use and what not to use. And so it is still a very small line compared to the entire Doc Martens line, which is insane, like thousands of styles. We have seen over the years the vegan line has grown from like two styles to like multiple, and now there's like, you know, maybe a dozen styles.
That's super cool. So, yeah. Joanne, you and Glenn recently became parents to adorable little Simi. So what has it been like raising a vegan child so far?
We've been really, really lucky because she has been very big and healthy ever since she was born. She was born nearly 9 pounds, and you know me, I'm quite petite.
Yeah.
And she's now one and a half, and she's never gone below the 80th percentile. So for us, we have gotten no scrutiny from families or doctors or parents or anything like that. So that was, I thought that was going to be one of the biggest challenges, you know, trying to convince people it's okay to raise a healthy vegan child. But people are obsessed with the size of children.
Yeah.
I don't know why. But I also want to say that, like, in the vegan community, when people talk about raising vegan children, we always talk about the, you know, the robust, the large, the healthy and smart child. But I feel like there's a lot of vegan parents who are silent and suffering because they are being scrutinized by family and friends and not being supported by the vegan community because their kids either skinny or smaller because, you know, genetics, whatever, mm-hmm. or like have health complications because of things that has nothing to do with diet.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think if you can get those parents to talk, you'll uncover a whole slew of unfair challenges that they face being vegans. But yeah, we've been lucky.
Yeah, that's a great point, actually. I never thought about that. I think that there's, that translates across a broad spectrum of things. I feel like vegans are held to a higher standard than everybody else, you know, for being in good health and stuff. People are scrutinizing our choices a lot more. Mm-hmm. So, and it's, right. Yeah, and people are quick to blame, you know, any issues, like any health problems or whatever on veganism, even if it has nothing to do with that. So...
Right, yeah, you know, and then you have vegans who actually get cancer and they're afraid to talk about it, things like
right.
that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's a great point. Do you have any advice for parents who are interested in raising a child on a plant-based diet?
There's really nothing special you have to do. You just have to feed them a variety of food, you know, make sure they get their calcium, their iron. It's no different than anybody who are raising a meat-eating child, especially when, you know, they're just starting to eat. Most kids eat fruits and, you know, mashed up vegetables and things like that. Mm-hmm. So it really is, so far I found it hasn't been any different than raising a normal child, and I mean a non-vegan child.
But Joanne, speaking of normal children, did you? This came out yesterday on Facebook. This video montage of all these children hating to eat their vegetables, and I saw it and I thought, well, those aren't the kids I know. The vegan kids all love their vegetables.
Yeah.
So what would you have to say about that? I mean, this video is meant to be funny, but I kind mm-hmm. I found it actually quite disturbing that these meat-eating children aren't eating, they hate vegetables, they look at broccoli and they want to throw up. Like, what do you have to say about that, and with regards to how Simi sees food?
Well, I think children emulate their parents, right? Like, mm-hmm. they have their blank slate, they come to the world and they just copy what their parents do. So if your parents have a diet where they just want to eat no vegetables and they hate the vegetables and the children see that, they're going to emulate that behavior. And also, you know, if you don't know how to cook vegetable, it's going to taste like terrible. Like, mm-hmm. I don't want to eat steamed broccoli, even though I love broccoli, you know? So the people need to learn to cook vegetable better, mm-hmm. and they need to learn to love vegetable, and their children will follow suit.
Yeah, that's good advice. So as you juggle running a business and being a parent, are you still able to find time to do animal rights activism? And if so, what sorts of actions or projects have you taken part in recently?
I feel like we do a lot of activism just at work because we get lots of vegan curious customers and just people who are open-minded, and being able to point them to like a documentary, a book, that has allowed a lot of customers to be able to go on that vegan journey, to take it a step further. Like yesterday, a couple came in. They're like, they just moved to Vancouver. They're like, we're vegetarians. We're not vegans. We're French. We need our cheese. And the great part of being in Vancouver is that there are so many different things you can just point people to. So I told them all about Blue Heron cheese, and they're very excited to try it. And I wouldn't be surprised they're going to go vegan.
That's
cool. Once that, cheese problem is solved.
Yeah, that's fantastic. We are very lucky, having an all-vegan cheese shop and all these other things. It's very easy. So what advice would you offer for folks in Vancouver who are looking to make the transition to a vegan lifestyle or become involved in animal advocacy?
You know, you just need to do one thing. Go on Facebook and join Vancouver Vegan.
Yeah.
That page is like, I tell every customer, everybody about it, because you go there and you get to find friends, you get to find out when all the activities are happening, where the restaurants are, where the sales are, and all this stuff. This is just a really great Facebook page, Vancouver Vegans.
Yeah, I would agree.
And Elise does a great job monitoring.
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah, it's true. I can't believe how much the group has grown over the years too.
How many members now?
It's over 7,200 now. When I first joined, I think it was maybe, I want to say 5 or 6 years ago, and there were like 300 of us, if that.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's over 7,200 people. And we get, typically at least a dozen new people a week, if not more.
And it's a great place to ask your questions. Like whenever someone asks, where can I buy vegan shoes? I always give a plug for Nice Shoes.
Right, absolutely.
Like, do you not know of Canada's only, are you still Canada's only vegan shoe shop, Joanne?
I feel like it. I don't look for, I think so. Mm-hmm. There might be something in a small town or something. I don't know.
You were in Toronto last week for the Toronto Veg Fair, right? And and if you travel that far, it's telling me you have customers across Canada.
Yeah, well, we have an online store, so we do get a lot of online stuff from Ontario and over that way, yeah.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So is there anything else that you particularly like about being vegan in Vancouver?
Being vegan in Vancouver, like, I think we already talked about how easy it is. Like, I mean, even, like I was saying, 7-8 years ago, we were like aliens. But now it's like, we used to have to go to Seattle, like multiple times a year to go to Seattle just to check out the new vegan products or good vegan products. But now, like, I haven't gone to the States or feel like I need to go to the States for years. And it's like, I'm not missing out on anything because we have everything here in Vancouver.
Yeah, absolutely. That's fantastic.
Do you guys feel that way? Like, you don't have to go to the States anymore to get stuff?
Oh, totally. Yeah, I think you're right, actually. Even just a few years ago, there were a lot of things that weren't available up here, but more and more stuff is becoming available.
But then my sister in the States, South Dakota, she keeps sending me Instagram photos of all these new products that are popping up in places like just regular stores that they have there in Target and Walmart. And I'm like, we don't have that. All these new flavors of ice cream that take about a year to get here.
Yeah.
So, but I'm not complaining at lack of options in Vancouver. I don't have time to eat all. You know, I just bought the new Häagen-Dazs last week, which is actually in Vancouver now. I don't know if you knew that. Yeah. I was going to post it on Vancouver Vegans. It's on sale at IGA.
Wow.
And yeah, like, but I don't, it's not like there's even time to go through every single flavor of vegan ice cream that we do have available in Vancouver.
Oh, I'll make time.
Yeah. And like IGA, you used to have to like go to Whole Foods or whatever to get them. Now you can get them everywhere.
That's
Save
true.
On.
I was surprised. I never go to
Super
IGA store. Anymore. And I popped in the other day and they had Daya cheesecakes as well on sale for $6.99. And like they have a large range of foods that they didn't used to have, because I used to go there before and I stopped going there years ago because it was like a Safeway.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
But they also carry Vogue cakes and desserts. Vogue is a Vogue.
Apparently. Never when I go there, but apparently.
Yeah, I've managed to find some and they're delicious, so keep an eye
out. Well, I got to try those. Well, thank you so much for coming on Animal Voices today, Joanne, and for sharing your story and your expertise with us.
Thank you for having me. It was a lot of fun.
Oh, for sure. It was great to talk with you. We've been speaking with Joanne Chang, local Vancouver activist and entrepreneur. If you'd like to check out Joanne's all-vegan shoe store, Nice Shoes, you can find it at 3568 Fraser Street in Vancouver or online at niceshoes.ca.
I'm wearing my boots right now.
Yeah. Oh, you know what? I'm wearing boots I bought from Nice Shoes, too. Amazing. You've been listening to Animal Voices here on 100.5 FM Vancouver Co-op Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, unceded Coast Salish territories. Please join us here next Friday, September 21st at noon. Allison, what do you have planned for us next week?
So September the 22nd, the day after, is actually World Rhino Day. We've never really covered rhinos before on the show, and there's a lot there in terms of them actually being critically endangered at this point. There's only 5 surviving species left, and as you know, we lost the last male white rhino earlier this year. So Ceci Seifert, she's the deputy director of the International Rhinos Foundation. She'll be on the show for World Rhino Day and to tell us about these conservation issues in Africa and poaching and issues like that, and then rhinos live in India as well. Hopefully as well we will have the filmmaker of the new film Dominion. His name is Chris Delforce. Hopefully we'll have an interview with him next week, and as I said, I'm going to be watching it tonight to do some research, and I'm looking forward to that. And if you missed it earlier in the show, we are having a film screening put on by Liberation BC and Surrey Chicken Save and the Vegan Project. That's on Wednesday, September the 26th at UBC Robson Square. And you can see that Facebook event on our Facebook page. I have it pinned to the top there, Animal Voices Vancouver.
Cool. Thank you. Yeah, so tune in next Friday at noon to hear those interviews. Once again, today's show is brought to you by Edible Planet, a Vancouver-based education campaign and TV series designed to teach people about the world's most powerful edible plants and the fascinating people who bring them to market. Food is the world's most powerful tool to share the wealth, help chronic illness, regreen the planet, and create lasting world peace today. Now is the time for a plant-based economy, because on this big, beautiful, edible planet, the food we eat can change the world. We here at Animal Voices want to connect with you online. Visit our website at animalvoices.org, where you can stream past shows or download them as podcasts. You can also see our show blog there with detailed links and subscribe to us on iTunes. Stay in touch with us on Facebook, facebook.com/Animal Voices Vancouver, and on Twitter at Animal Voices YVR. So now we'll leave you with a piece of music. In keeping with the themes of Greenpeace Day and Coastal Cleanup Day, I wanted to share with you a piece inspired by the ocean in all its mighty and furious beauty. This, what you're hearing right now, is Play of the Waves from La Mer, the Sea, by Claude Debussy. Stay tuned for Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Thank you for listening to Animal Voices today, and remember to be kind to the animals.